May it please the court, counsel. My name is Melvin Welch, W-E-L-C-H, on behalf of Mr. Mohamed Jerinow. Your Honor, the appellant, Mr. Jerinow, appeals his conviction of criminal sexual conduct in the second degree and domestic assault by strangulation. The basis for this challenge to his conviction, Your Honor, is the sufficiency of evidence. Essentially, this is a case that relies upon the testimony of Ms. Lul Abdul Qadir, who was his wife at the time of the incident, and the jury conviction. Ms. Abdul Qadir provided two different statements. Initially, a statement following a very traumatic evening of a serious car accident in which she was nearly killed, nearly crushed by a semi-truck. She gave a very detailed recounting of the effects of that incident upon her, the effects of her husband, Mr. Jerinow's unresponsiveness to her near-death experience, his frustration and his challenging her driving conditions, her anger towards him. She provided a very detailed testimony regarding the incident that happened inside of the hotel room at that time. She also provided a different statement earlier and shortly after the incident, the alleged assault between herself and Mr. Jerinow in the hotel room to law enforcement approximately 20 minutes later.
And to the desk clerk person, right?
Correct, Your Honor. I just want to go through briefly the effect of those two different statements, Your Honor, because we're dealing with one, which is a sworn statement in court that's been provided to a jury, a sworn statement under oath that is consistent with numerous recantations by Ms. Jerinow, including the day after the alleged assault occurred, within a month after to the prosecution, within 2 months after to the defense attorney, essentially a woman who said, I made a false statement. I am affecting a man, an innocent man's life, and I am concerned that my involvement in this is going to cause him to be incarcerated for a period of time that I have no idea, and he is innocent. And you can sense in her testimony, you can sense in her letters, the frustration at not being heard, not being received by the powers that are pursuing the conviction of this man, she says, is and claims is innocent.
That particular argument, that is, which of the versions should be believed, is typically one that we defer to the jury because the jury is in a better position to make the kinds of judgments you're now asking us to make than we are.
And I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. Ultimately, what I'm relying upon here is State versus Webb, 440 Northwestern, 2D426, 1989 Minnesota Supreme Court case, where the court was looking at evidence related to a conviction of a first-degree murder of Webb and looking over the circumstantial evidence as it related to his consistency, or as it related to the consistency with his conviction of guilt.
I would like you also to address why we should, why our analysis should be under circumstantial versus direct evidence. The state says they were her direct statements.
Yes,
that's evidence of, that's direct evidence, not circumstantial evidence. So if you could also address that standard of review.
In the first, her statements, I would submit to the court, are direct. What she says to law enforcement approximately 20, 25 minutes after the incident occurs. But I also am looking at what the circumstances are surrounding her statements to law enforcement, the circumstances surrounding the particular incident at the time.
Wouldn't that go to credibility, though, and weight to be given, not to our standard of review analysis?
I would submit to the court it should go to the weight of review analysis, or to the review analysis rather than the credibility, merely because we're dealing with two different versions of what occurred in the room. One which is a testimony under oath, the other which is a statement provided several tens of minutes later. And I may very well be wrong on that, Your Honor, but ultimately what we're doing is assessing the whether or not the circumstances surrounding the statements are consistent with one or the other, and whether or not those circumstances are consistent with interpretation of innocence, or inconsistent with any rational hypothesis except that of guilt, to take the language from the case.
So let me see if I understand your argument. Are you suggesting that we sort of take the proof, and depending on what type of proof it is, some of it, as you already said, is direct evidence, the statements that were made by the victim to, for instance, the police. That's direct evidence. But the circumstantial evidence, like the buttons in the room, and some of the other evidence, the alarm clock pulled out of the wall, that we would all view differently? Is that what you're saying?
No, I would submit that that's evidence to be reviewed in light of the statement that she provided in her testimony, as well as the statement that she provided to the law enforcement at the scene. I guess, to some extent, we are assessing the credibility of which statement here, Your Honor, that was provided to law enforcement, or that which was provided under oath, and whether or not the circumstances are consistent with that statement. In the statement that she provided under testimony, she did provide state that we were in the room, we argued, Mr. Jarinow left, he returned later, the argument continued. Ultimately, at some point, he told me that we were going to separate, he was going to leave me. I became belligerent, I yelled, attempted to hit him. We struggled over the cellular phone. At some point when I told him I didn't need anything from him, he said, well, you have my shirt on, and she ripped off the shirt, for example. The buttons are in a location that would be consistent with where she ripped off the shirt. The next-door neighbor, I believe his name was Mr. Candia, Wayne Candia, testified that he had heard some type of tumbling against the wall. Law enforcement later went into the room, took a look at what had occurred, saw that there was an issue with the alarm that was connected to the wall. Ms. Abdul Qadir had said, I attempted to tear the alarm out of the wall. It was connected to the wall. Again, consistent with her testimony, inconsistent with her statement to law enforcement shortly thereafter. Ms. Abdul Qadir testified that she had been in the bed, but that there had been no struggle on the bed. Law enforcement went into the room. They looked at the room. They looked at the bed. They saw the bed was disheveled, but not torn apart, which would be consistent with her statement to law enforcement at the time, that she was strangled on the bed and attempted to be sexually assaulted or was sexually assaulted on the bed. Again, we're looking at what is consistent here with her statement to law enforcement some tens of minutes after the incident versus what her testimony was under oath to a jury. And ultimately, Your Honor, I believe that the testimony or the evidence comes up short in supporting a verdict of guilt against Mr. Jarinow. There is a statement that was made shortly thereafter where all of the investigation and all of the observations do not support and are inconsistent with a finding of guilt. In other words,
so going back to my original question, Judge Bradfield's question, so how do we analyze the testimony that she ran down to the front desk counter without her shoes, told the attendant that someone was trying to kill her and to call the police? She appeared distraught. She was coughing a lot. On the 911 call, she can be heard in the background saying, you're not going to get away with this. And then there were the witnesses from the surrounding room who talked about the terrifying screams from the room. How are you urging us to or advocating for us to analyze that evidence?
I'm asking the court to analyze it in light of her testimony, which was, at the time this incident occurred, I had very little sleep, and this is now in the words of Ms. Abdul Qadir, I'd had very little sleep. I had nearly been crushed by a semi-truck.
And this is her testimony at trial.
Correct, Your Honor. Yep. I had had very little sleep. I've been nearly crushed by a vehicle, very traumatic, that she suffered from I think it was PTSD she identified in her testimony from a different incident, and that as this traumatic experience and this fight was occurring, she was responding in a distraught manner based upon her emotional status at the time, which was tired, disturbed from her near-death experience, traumatized from her prior PTSD experience, and that she reacted in a manner upon this fight with her husband and her anger towards him that was consistent with that emotional state at the time, that she was very angry with him, that she, as she testified, became belligerent with him, and that ultimately she became vindictive towards him in how she reacted to the fight with him in making the allegations against him and making the allegations that she was almost killed. And even in there, there's conflict. She says to, I can't remember the name of the individual right now, Brian Raines, the lobby attendant. Someone's trying to kill me, but yet then later when she's discussing with them, well, I'm not injured. When they're looking through the photographs, she says, well, I was strangled, I couldn't breathe, but then in the photographs, there's no redness, there's no swelling. Law enforcement says, I believe I see some, which is very thin evidence. Miss Abdul Qadir, who knows herself far better, knows her physical makeup, says, no, there's no issues there, there's no marks there. And she does identify that she also has a condition. I can't remember what the condition is, some type of skin rash or something like that. But in any event, she is providing information later when she has calmed down from the stress of the situation and realizes what she's done, that is consistent with her testimony. Her recantations that she provides several times to the state, to defense, to the court, to an investigator, is consistent with her testimony. So when we're looking at consistency of testimony, we're also looking at those prior consistent statements as well and the weight that they would have on it. Ultimately, I think that one thing that strikes me here is this a very disheartening strain that Mr. Gerno collects himself, walks out, sits down outside, and is asked by law enforcement, you know, what's going on, and he says, well, I'm going to be arrested, because whenever a woman calls law enforcement, the man is arrested. And whether or not that's right, it certainly is. It's disheartening, because when you couple that with Ms. Abdul Qadir's consistent and persistent protestations of her then-husband's innocence, she receives the same responsiveness from the authorities that Mr. Gerno does, which is, well, you know, there's an accusation, and now we're gonna put it up to the jury. Ultimately, as a prosecutor, there is some responsibility here to consider the evidence, consider whether or not there is an issue here. And the prosecution here says, we are not going to listen to anything that is being told to us by Ms. Qadir, Abdul Qadir. We have this prior incident. We have decided that this is sufficient for us, and we're going to go forward with it. And when you have this, it's almost a community perspective of this mistreatment or lack of responsiveness to the lack of responsiveness to the circumstances, either whether that's through cultural understanding or whether that's through observations by Mr. Gerno or Ms. Abdul Qadir, it's a bit disheartening because it almost reflects that there is a not a responsive jury or justice system for them when there are emotional circumstances, when people do make mistakes, as Ms. Abdul Qadir has vehemently and continuously asserted.
You haven't argued, I don't think, that the out-of-court statements by the alleged victim were improperly admitted, true?
I have not, Your Honor, no.
Okay. And I'm looking at the closing argument that was given at trial, and it sounds an awful lot like, it reads an awful lot like your argument here today.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, yes.
So I'm still back on, how do I say that I'm better situated than the jury to determine which statement is true?
I think ultimately, Your Honor, we have an opportunity to review the record with all of the evidence before us in a manner that is not in the heat of the moment, not in a recollection that occurs as the time goes through, but rather consistently looking at the pieces of evidence that are preserved in memory, that are preserved in a stone record that's there for all time, and to say what is truth here. And ultimately, this is a system where we're looking to correct any errors, and I would submit to this court the jury conviction is such an error. Barring any other questions?
It appears we have none. You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal, of course. Mr. Stockmeyer.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General appearing this morning on behalf of Respondent, the State of Minnesota. I think I'd like to begin with the questions that were asked about the standard of review. As I explained in the brief, the evidence, the out-of-court statements, that's direct evidence of what occurred. The victim testified about what was done to her, what the defendant said. That's all direct evidence. But I want to make a slightly different point this morning, and that is, even if we were to apply the circumstantial evidence standard of review, what would the facts look like under that review? And specifically, I want to highlight that even under the circumstantial evidence standard of review, we still, when defining the set of circumstances proved, we still disregard facts that are inconsistent with the verdict. We defer to the jury's credibility determinations of conflicting evidence, and we look at the evidence in the light most favorable to guilt. And so when we're determining, if we were to apply that standard here and we were to set out the circumstances proved, those would look like the facts set out in the victim's out-of-court statements. Her testimony during trial would be mostly disregarded. If you look at the Harris decision, you know, the state lost that case, but I really
like... Is that cited in your brief?
It is, not for this proposition, but it is, Your Honor, in the standard of review section. The Supreme Court talks about when you set out the circumstances proved, you have to winnow down the evidence to a set of facts. You don't look at all the evidence. You have to winnow it down. You have to bracket out those things that are either inconsistent with the verdict, that obviously the jury would have disregarded based on its verdict, and which are conflicting with the state's main evidence. And so even if we were to apply that standard of review, the outcome would be the same. So I really don't think that the standard of review question is the important question here. The important question is what evidence was contained in the out-of-court statements. Specifically, the victim testified that the appellant told her he made aggressive sexual advances towards her. He placed his hand on her intimate part, her clothed intimate part. He said that this belongs to him and he should get it when he wants. She stated that he tore her shirt, breaking the buttons. She stated that when she declined his aggressive advances, he pinned her on the bed and choked her. When he temporarily stopped choking her, she apologized, but then she again rejected his advance, and he resumed choking her. She testified that her breathing was impeded both times she was choked and that she was frightened for her life. And so regardless of which standard of review we apply, those are the facts, and those establish beyond any reasonable doubt that this assault occurred contrary to the victim's trial testimony. And unless the court has any further questions, I would simply ask that this court affirm Mr. Jarno's convictions.
It appears we have none. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Welch, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time.
No, Your Honor, I'll waive any rebuttal.
Very well. Thank you. The matter is submitted, and we'll issue our decision within 90 days. We thank both of counsel for your briefing and argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.